Today is Monday, November 9th, 2020, and I want to say Boker Tov u'Mevorach to all the wonderful faces looking at me from the screen. I just received bad news, and I want to just extend condolences. Rabbi Dr. Howard Rosner died last night, a mismach of the yeshiva, PhD from NYU, I believe. And his brother Elliot has been my student the first time around about 50 years ago, and the second time around when he came in Aliyah a year or two ago. And it hurts. His brother devoted his life to chinuch, both in America and here. And Vic Snow knew him very well. Skivena Yidit Tzadik, a fabulous family. The families that we dream about, dedication to Am Yisrael, Torah Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael. And I just want to say to Eliyahu, Hamakom Yenachem Otcha B'toch Shavei L'Tzion V'Yerushalayim V'lo Tosif L'Da'ava Od. I want to just add one more word about yesterday's shiur, where I spoke about Rav David Feinstein. So I mentioned Reb David, you know, you have to understand the Feinstein children grew up in America. His sister married, and Rebellia Moshe Shiskal. That was the last name. If you recall yesterday, I said I don't recall this last name, but it fell into my head, as usual, after the shiur. And his other sister married Reb Moshe David Tendler. Rev. Reuven Feinstein, as I recall, married Sheila Kaplan, who was my brother's shavit in Bnei Akiva. She died recently, a very capable lady who actually was principal of a city high school, which is quite a responsibility. And I call your attention that both Rev. Moshe Feinstein's sons-in-law were named Moshe. So it's very interesting. Rav Elia Moshe Shiskal and Rav Moshe David Tendler. And just to say a few words, Rabbi Shiskal is gone many, many years. He died very young. He was Kula Torah. His father was a Rav on the east side, a Yerupeya Shadar. Sheila Kaplan's father also was a Rav on the east side. And Rav Elia Moshe was a Torah Vadas product. His whole life was learning. He was kulo Torah. And Rav Moshe raised, you have to give credit, this is not an easy achievement. Communist Russia, come to America, struggles in America till you find your place. And all the four children turned out fabulously. And Reb David was Reb David. He was the greatest lamdan among the family on the level of psak halacha. I don't want to start giving out awards, but Reb Moshe David Tendler was more the great Talmud Chacham, also a scientist who at times combined the two and helped us immensely achieve a so-called ideal of what Yeshiva University is striving for. Reb David was an edler mensch, very, very special. I saw him, I knew him, I took my grandchildren in the late 90s or mid-90s. I took two grandchildren with me to the United States, and we visited MTJ, and there was Reb David, and he greeted these youngsters so warmly. And he was a great individual, very down to earth. Understood the American scene well, and halavai, we should have more like him. To heinish matotz ru b'tzruach chayim. It's a generation moving on, and part of my age, Kohelet, is I don't get the phone calls about bar mitzvahs anymore, and engagements and weddings, but you can fill in the rest of the sentence. It's not a happy feeling, but it's a reality of life. With Morty Willig, Rabbi Willig, I was wrong. You're absolutely right. I was guessing perhaps he had a law degree, because in order to come up with the Tanayim he came up with the prenup, he shows great legal understanding. But no, it's you know, a good head. You can pick up a lot of information. What he did achieve, and it was a BA in mathematics from Yeshiva College, and a master's in Jewish history from the Bernard Revel Graduate School. So he did have advanced degrees, but not a legal degree. My Talmud Rabbi Francis is asking me seriously. I said in class I was in Meir in 1930, I was in Slabodka, I was in Bris, I was in Voloshin, etc. Absolutely. But all you know, I'm sure you understand that your age, I was not there physically. But in order to understand Torah history, you have to live it. If you don't live it, Noach, you're not going to really understand it. And the way we can live Torah history, in modern times we have the advantage that there is a great deal of memoir literature. And memoir literature is very important. I don't want to elaborate now, we've spoken about it many times, because it gives you a very realistic picture. And even if you'll say, well, he's not right, but it doesn't matter, that's what this person thought. In addition, I need not tell you, if you studied with me in my Sunday class since 1978, the Koilel began a formal program, all of you know that responsible literature, what we did yesterday itself, you relived the period, the Gentile doctor, the chauffeur, the blowing, the people, the hunger, modernity, the impact on life. So you can live history, and that's exactly what I meant. With last week's shiur, I mentioned something, if you recall, about a non-Jewish choir. So Rabbi Dr. Bill Gvirtz, a fabulous Jew, a big Talmud Chacham, so he tells the story. He traveled to about 22 plus years ago. I had to travel often to Brussels in Belgium. So he describes, he comes to the shul, and at the end of davening, some Jews come over to him. You see the organs. This was once a Reformed temple. And when they, you know, it's like the story of Queens with the conservative temples, there are no more Reformed Jews left. So they became Orthodox, but the organs remained there. It's not that they used them, but I guess it was part of the atmosphere. And but the one, when it was a Reformed temple, they had a choir. And the choir, they refused to part with. So they made a deal that on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, when the big crowd comes, they would use the choir. There's only one problem. The choir was non-Jewish, basically. So the Orthodox rabbi arranged that the choir never sung with the chazan. Never. In other words, the organ was not used, but they all agreed to a choir. Nebuch, there were no really good voices, and the Orthodox Jews agreed to a non-Jewish choir made up of opera singers. However, the choir never sang with the chazan, only singing parts that the kahal was saying. So that's where he saw the non-Jews, the choir on Shabbos. And I can tell you, if you're familiar with Washington, I write about the Reformed Temple on, I believe it was on the Grand Concourse, and there too they had a choir, and it was also mainly non-Jews. Also, he tells me, we mentioned about the tie, so he tells me a story. I think I've mentioned this in class years ago. I know that Nachum Lam was an eyewitness to this. Bernard Weber Graduate School Professor Elman, Zichrono Livracha, was a terrific individual and a big Talmud Chacham and terrific in academia, and he was a Chassidish Jew. So when they finished class and they wanted a daf mincha, he needed a gattel. No one had a gattel. Who walks around in YU with a gattel? Though today could be there are just the people there, lo aleinu, without kippah, there are people there with gattels.
It's hard to find people without gattels in YU.
People what?
It's hard to find people without gattels in YU.
Without gattels. Halavai, you're right. I'm in favor. So Professor Zelman would take off his tie, and his tie would become his gato. I also had many stories about Lander College, Turo. They've experimented many different ways with how to become like Yeshiva College, not like Yeshiva College, more Jewish, more general. And Rabbi Jeff Francis wrote that he remembers, let me see, in the late 80s, early 90s, they were running a program in Brooklyn in Shulamit School off Avenue M. I know where it is. And they wanted to attract Yeshiva Yungalite. And they were able to work out a program taught by Turo faculty. And these courses were accepted. And ultimately, they could get a degree, a bachelor's in liberal arts. The classes were attended by fellows studying at Chaim Berlin, Tairav Adas, Demir, Yeshivat Birkat Ruvain, and many other smaller yeshivas in Brooklyn and Queens, including Yeshiva B'nai Torah, Chavetz Chaim, Shai Yashav Institute, and Yeshiva Far Rockaway. This program enabled the students to complete a liberal arts degree in approximately 2 years and made us eligible to receive federal financial aid and grants. So you see, you got credit for your yeshiva studies, and this liberal arts program in Shulamit, Turo College faculty people. So what do you see from here? The swing to the right. Turo was in the right place at the right time. It's a success story, because here you have endless yeshiva boys, a lot of anti-college pressure in the yeshivat. How many Torah V'das boys do you see going to college today? Compare 2020 with 1950. 1950, I would say 90% of the Torah V'das boys went to college. 90% of Chaim Berlin. I may be underestimating when I say 90. And today, I don't think you're going to rise too much above zero. So, but Lander was there. On the other hand, this answers Jay Solomon's question. What was YU's attitude? So I quoted to you what I heard. Remember, I'm living in Israel since 69. So basically, I was not in America. I was not on top of the factory, on top of the store, when all this was happening in the United States. But I did hear the comment, Yeshiva University, I can even tell you I heard it from. Remember, these are people who gave millions to YU. And they said, YU gives you an education, Turo College gives you a degree. So you see, right here, 2 years, and it's equal to 4 years, all right, Hamevin Yavin. All right, but now I want to go further. And what I said last week, you can't believe how timely I was. Again, Friday I get all the freebies. One of the great things about living here is that you get all these freebies for Shabbos. It's a pleasure. So I'm going to quote from Shvi'i now. But if you remember my shiur last week, I showed you the question of how to relate to non-Orthodox is a problem that has haunted us for on to 120, 130 years. It goes back to Germany, and I quoted the Netziv to you, and lo and behold, this is a beautiful article with colored pictures of the two Rabbanim involved, and it's really a nidui here. It's like a get rid of him, like someone who's coming out of quarantine. They want to put these people into quarantine. I'm happy to see Eli assigned that Sachita L'Refua Shleima. A Talmud just walked in who was in isolation, and I'm overjoyed to see him. Anyway, what happened was very simple. Rav Melamed, one of the Choshev Rabbanim, one of the great poskim of our times, a terrific, his Sfarim are fabulous. I've gone through some of them, and it's written for this generation. In other words, it's the kids growing up here in 20 years, they'll probably, at least in the Tzioni Dati world, they're going to take his Sfarim in place of the Mishnah Berurah, because he's really speaking in the language of today with the problems of today, and he's a Posek Mufak, a Lamdan Mufak. All right, then a Yidat Tzaddik, the Malamed family, it's not a small matter, he's Dorsh Shiva Bhabracha. So he met, under the sponsorship of the World Zionist Organization, with rabbis, so-called rabbis, spiritual leaders from Europe. And among them was a reformed female rabbi from France. And recently they had a Zoom conference where he again spoke with her. And the chief rabbi, Rav Yitzchak Yosef, actually is a very interesting article. I recommend it to you. And Chief Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef actually put him in nidui. You got to read the article. Ad kedei kach, that you speak with people who are totally uproot all religion. I mean, I can quote Rakefet to you. In the marriage, what's going on in America now, the vice president is married to a Jew. God have mercy. The president of the United States, I just learned this morning, I didn't read it in detail, but I think it's two sons-in-law who are Jewish, or two daughters-in-law who are Jewish. If the daughters-in-law are Jewish too, he has Jewish grandchildren. He's like Trump already. But the assimilation, what happens when you don't, and here you have people, you got to remember that they tell you you don't have to observe Shabbat. I mean, let's be honest. You can drive to Reed, Washington. I can't go into, you all heard me lecture over the decades on my big debate with Rabbi Teddy Friedman. If you permit people to drive to Shabbos, know what's left of Shabbos. And kashrut, you can have tarfas outside of the house, eating the treif restaurant. And you, I mean, here you have kalim that they just boiled chazer on, bacon and ham. And a half hour later, you're ordering fish and vegetables, fish and chips, etc. Taret mishpacha, forget about it. We have showers, we have baths in our house. Why do we need a primitive ritual going to mikvah? They abolish everything. And how dare you speak with these people and treat them as equal spiritual leaders? Well, Rav Melamed replies to Rav Yosef, and I'm sure he didn't hear my shiur of last week. What do you think he replies with? No, the Meshiv Dover, then it's there. He quotes the Meshiv Dover at length. Now, I want to be very honest. I did portray the Meshiv Dover. The truth of the matter is you can't entirely quote the Meshiv Dover on the contemporary issue. What I said last week, everything was correct. It's not that I misled and that the Meshiv Dover influenced the Rav's thinking. It goes without saying. It's his great-grandfather. It's nishta kleinikait. It's not a small matter to be a great-grandson of the Nitziv, okay? The Rav, you should know, by the way, you know, when I went to the Rav Shia, I was a kid. I didn't know that much, which I want to make a comment on right after this. I didn't know that much. So the Rav, you know, I was a kid. I went in, it was my third year of college. Reed, Washington, how I got that Shia, the Rav, and everything. And the Rav used to talk about Rav Heschel Leib, Rav Heschel Leib. I didn't know who he meant. So finally, I asked one of the oldest students from the Smicha class. They said, Reb Heschel Leib is in Yiddish. That's what he was called. There was the Nitziv, Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was Reb Heschel Leib in Yiddish. So it took me a while. I can tell you also, the Mashgiach used to speak about Reb Itzela Petterburger. Reb Itzela Petterburger. Reb Itzela. And the Rav used to speak about Rav Yitzchak Glazer. It wasn't until I went through Tenua Tamusa that I realized they're talking about the same person. That's how stupid I was. Just in parentheses, I want to boast, you'll forgive me. It's a good boast. I want to thank Arye Liebman. Arye Liebman, my Talmud of many decades from the Chabad area, sent me a link to a talk that Atara Tversky gave, the Rav's old eldest daughter, who Jay Solomon knows well. The talk was given in 2013, and it's on YU Torah. and she speaks about her father. It's a 25-minute talk. She speaks about her father in the 30s into the 40s. My dear students, I never had more nachat in my life. You've heard my shirm on the Rav in the 20s, the 30s, who is not yet the Rav, given recently. There's a Torah, 7 years ago. His daughter, the widow of Professor Yitzchak Tversky / Talna Rebbe, her description of the Rav, I couldn't believe word by word what you heard in class. Baruch Shekivanti, I am proud. I didn't know the Rav in the 30s, 40s. This is all the result of honest research. But wow, he was not yet the Rav. Who did you hear that from? Aaron Reich Catholic. Atara, he was not yet the Rav. And she goes through the tzaras he had. It's worth listening to Dr. Atara Soloveitchik Tversky's talk on her father. Worth listening. I don't think Tova could have given a talk like that, because Tova was younger, much younger. So there's a big difference. When you're already 5 years old, you can understand what your Abba is going through. Big difference if you're only 2 years old, 1 year old, etc. Okay, coming back here, you see that Netziv is dealing with the Eastern European reality. The Eastern European reality was not as extreme as what happened in Germany. In Germany, and lo aleinu, the United States, there's total assimilation. In Germany, there was mass conversion to be accepted, to be a professor, Heinrich Heine, you can go names, one name after another. In order to make the grade, you converted. In Eastern Germany, there was a lot of assimilation, but it didn't result in total intermarriage and total loss of Judaism. It resulted in secular Zionism. It resulted in socialism, Bundesism. Bund was the Jewish branch of the socialist movement. And it could very well be that there everyone has to agree with the Netziv. You got to keep the communication open. But in an era and an area where you're fighting total, total disregard for anything Jewish, I don't know whether you can quote the Netziv. I'm not saying there's only one way to go. Obviously there's not. There's a tremendous controversy here. But the Netziv has to be seen. I alluded to it last week, but because of this article already, let me go a little deeper. Yes, what was good for Eastern Europe, secular Zionists, at least they believed in Eretz Yisrael. Secular Zionism came about because of our belief in messianicism. Just think, that's an absolute fact. Socialism, Bundism, well, the Torah speaks about treating a slave with dignity. The Torah speaks about when you buy a home in a walled city, which means you're wealthy. It have 1 year when you sell it, 1 year to redeem it. Afterwards, wealth doesn't remain in any family. The new family takes it over. It's not like your stay achuzah, where the right to redeem is a lot more than 1 year. And you can make a whole case for socialism, and it had more Jewish content. But Germany was like the United States. The only difference being that here, there's no religion whatsoever in the world today. In Europe, the churches are empty on Sunday. Some churches, they just keep around so when Jewish tourists come, they can look at the church and look at the ceiling. You understand what I'm saying? It's a tourist attraction. They make money. In America, where do you see churches crowded? In the Bible Belt. In Texas, we once drove through Texas from Dallas to Austin on Sunday. There you saw churches, wow, and parking lots filled. But you go to Washington, D.C., when was the last time Trump was in church? Biden was in church. There's no religion left. You don't have to convert away. You're just like Kissinger. You take your Yiddishkeit. Hard to believe what Kissinger, mother with a scheitel, Ask Charlie, Dr. Charlie Hexter will fill you in details. The father was a gabbai in the Breuer's Minyan in Adachi Shura in KAJ in Washington Heights. And they became, and it just didn't convert away. But es ist nicht geblieben a Breckel Yiddishkeit. There's not a trace how many Jewish lives he killed with the Yom Kippur War, that he wouldn't let us call up, he wouldn't let us get the reserves ready, that we were totally, now that all the records are out and all has been revealed, it's not that we were totally surprised. Our leaders knew what was happening, but they couldn't react. They their hands were tied. Kissinger said, let the Arabs enjoy a victory, and then they'll make peace. That's more than 3,000 of our soldiers fell in the Yom Kippur War, and I was already here 5 years at the time, 4 years at the time. I cannot tell you how many people I knew, two Madrichim from BMT, which was all of 4 years old, never came back from the Yom Kippur War. So, okay, this machloket haunts us. When is the first time this machloket hits the United States? Gentlemen, citing from an interesting volume, Bernard Revel, Builder of American Jewish Orthodoxy. A guy named Aaron Rothkopf, who no longer exists, but he did a good job. Page 174. And the first time we have the machloket is in Boston. What happened, and I found all these papers in my earlier Gilgal, I found all the papers of this machloket. It was 1939, and you had in Boston a branch of the Agudas HaRabbanim. There were a lot of Europeisha Rabbanim there. The Rav had already arrived in 1932, by 39, he was established. And you already had some Americanized Rabbanim. The leading one was Rabbi Jacob Agus. Rabbi Rubin can tell you about him. Rabbi Jacob Agus, we've spoken about, he was a Talmud Muvhak of Rabbi Revel, of Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, and he was one of the leading rabbis. Now, there's a dilemma that you face. Who do you feel more comfortable with? And I'll put the dilemma right to you, the young rabbi sitting in front of me. Who do you feel more comfortable with? A Rav from the old country who speaks Yiddish, doesn't speak English, were not comfortable in English, never went to high school, never went to college, or the reform and conservative rabbi who grew up in America, are all high school graduates, college graduates, speak a perfect English, can relate, let's go 1939, baseball, the Yankees, the Red Sox, DiMaggio, Ted Williams already was in the major leagues. 39 was his first year, if my memory is correct. DiMaggio was a major leaguer since 36. That I don't make a mistake about, because when people ask me my age, I always say I was born the second year of Joe DiMaggio in the major leagues. Who do you feel more comfortable with? Now you think for a minute. And you now have in Boston, in addition to the Elter Rabbanim, the Agudas HaRabbanim people, you have a board of rabbis. And Agus is a member. By the way, I want to tell you in parentheses, the Rav was caught between two worlds. Ultimately, he becomes much more comfortable with RCA when RCA takes center stage. In 1939, it was still a mini organization, a nascent organization, a tyro organization, call it what you wish. And he ultimately shifts gears. He becomes much more comfortable with RCA than HaKadosh HaRabbanim. And the Elder Rabbanim contact the yeshiva, and they complain to Rabbi Revel bitterly. And they say to Rabbi Revel, your graduate, Jacob Agus, is destroying us. Until now, we always told the Balabatim, you can't depend upon the board of rabbis. They have no smicha. They can't paskin a shaila. You can only depend upon the elder Rabbanim, European trained, etc. Now that Jacob Agus is a member, we can't say that. He's a Talmud Chacham. He's a graduate. They say that in Baltimore, when students in Ne'er Yisrael had a problem with Gemara, they would go to Jacob Agus quietly, secretly. He's a Lamdan, knew how to learn. And here, he's a member of the Board of Rabbis. Well, yeshiva had to act. At that time, Rabbi Revel is a member of the Gerus HaRabbanim. He's, as I write about in Revel, he was subject to their pressure. It's not like Rabbi Belkin, who totally removed himself from the Gerus HaRabbanim and told them, don't bother me, I don't bother you. They couldn't pressure him. But Rabbi Revel was bread and butter, basa v'cholav, basa v'yayin, I wanted to say. He was not part of the HaKadosh HaRabbanim. Rabbi Leventhal made him president of yeshiva. This is HaKadosh HaRabbanim. So he sent Dean Zahr to Boston to address the rabbis. Now, Dean Samuel Zahr, Shmuel Leib Zahr, Shalaz, we used to call him, Shmuel Leib Zahr, Rashlaz, we used to call him. Again, how many of you remember him? I say, I'm looking at, I can't believe it, I'm the eldest person here right now, I think. And how many of you remember him? Reb Shmuel Leib Zahr was one of the brightest people I ever met. He was a Telzha from Europe. He was an uncle of Reb Mordechai Gifta. Do you know who Reb Mordechai Gifta? Telzha Rosh Yeshiva, right? This was his uncle, who sent him from Yeshiva University. It wasn't university yet, but he was an MTA graduate. He sent his nephew to Telz in Europe, that's where you're going to become a Talmud Chacham. And I don't have to tell you, it boomeranged to a certain degree, because Rav Mordechai Gifter was not exactly a friend of Yeshiva University, even though he always admitted that they put him on the track of Torah. He was a Talmud of MTA. He was a Talmud of Rabbi Moshe Aaron Palayev. That was his Rebbe Mufak, and he corresponded. The sperm were published later. But there were other problems later in life where he broke with the whole Yeshiva University scene. And Shmuel Leib Zahr wound up in England. He was there when the Rosh Yeshiva of Telz died. The Rosh Yeshiva of Telz came to England collecting funds, Reb Lazer Gordon, collecting funds, the great Reb Lazer Gordon. He was in England right at the start of World War I, or right before. He was collecting funds for Telz Yeshiva, and he died there. Had a lot of Akmas Nefesh, people didn't want to contribute. It's not like today that we have wealthy Orthodox Jews. Today, when I was growing up, it was like a contradiction. How can you be Orthodox and be wealthy? How can you be wealthy and Orthodox? There were exceptions, but the real money was in the hands of the Reform and Conservative. Now, today, it's very different. Today, the real money is, plenty of real money is in the hands of good from Jews. And he eulogized his Rebbe in London. And Reb Shmuel Leib Zahr told me when he got up to speak, his legs were shaking, because he said it was really the first time I addressed such a large crowd. Pablo was in Yiddish, but still, he was overwhelmed. Then he comes to America, and he comes to the yeshiva, and he was Rabbi Revel's right hand. Revel trusted him implicitly. Like, I depend upon the Yomo, and sometimes I dictate letters to Yomo answering questions in Halacha, or questions in Hashkafa, or questions in sources, Jewish history, and Yomo will correct me or add his thinking, and I have to deal with it. I trust Yomo. And I just told my nephew, because we answered a Shaila, and Yomo put in fancy English words, so I told my nephew, he called me yesterday on the phone, I told him that Yomo knows English better than I do, so if you don't know what the words mean, ask Yomo, don't ask me. But Rabbi Revel trusted Rav Shmuel Leib Zion implicitly. I can add on, later when Rabbi Belkin took over the yeshiva, so of course when a new king comes in, he has his own people that he leans on. And by the 1950s, I was very close to Shmuel Leib Zion. He was a wonderful vigil. And he says to me, "Arnold, I'm afraid the more titles and honors I get, the less influence I have." And he was right. Rabbi Belkin gave him a title, Dean of Students. And he got the awards from the yeshiva. And the more titles he got, he had no influence whatsoever. He was left in charge, one area, of getting your 4D for being a divinity student and not being drafted into the army. That's what he was in charge of. There was the World War II, there was Korea, etc. It's very interesting how he died. It's an amazing story, but a true story. 1962, in those years, every year, yeshiva would have a little party for its smicha graduates. Not the Chag HaSmicha. Chag HaSmicha was every 3 or 4 years. That was a big deal. But, you know, there's a picture I believe, both in the Rav, my work on my Rebbe, and also in Washington of my smicha class. That was an individual event with Rabbi Belkin and Mori Rebbe the Rav, and they had a nice reception for us. We came with our wives. That was a private deal. That wasn't the Chag HaSmicha. Chag HaSmicha was a few years later. In 62, there also was a small Chag HaSmicha, but that 62 affair was in the Beis Medrash. And Shmuel Leib Zion shared the event, and he got up and spoke and gave a charge to the young Mesmachim. He sat down in the Beis Medrash, we called it the Harry Fischel Beis Medrash, I don't know what it's called today, if they sold the name again, but he sat down, keeled over, had a heart attack, died in the Beit Medrash, 62 in the yeshiva. Now you know some of his descendants, without going into great detail, his grandson is Dr. Ephraim Zuroff, the Nazi hunter, the man who did the PhD on Varhatzalah, and later, and until today, for decades, has worked for Wiesenthal Center, hunting down Nazis all over the world. That is a grandson. His daughter, Reb Shmuel Leib Zion's daughter Esther, was married to Rabbi Abe Zuroff, and Effie Zuroff is the son of Rabbi Abe. He lives in Efrat. He's lived in Israel many decades. As a matter of fact, when he did his doctorate, I remember I gave him whatever I had from the Silva archives, and he had the advantage that by the time he did his doctorate at Hebrew U, the Varhatzalah archives are open while you had them, so he had a lot more material to work on. It's a very fascinating doctorate. I highly recommend it to you, but I don't want to discuss it further. But this was Reb Shmuel Leib Zion. Reb Shmuel Leib Zion pleaded with Rabbi Jacob Agus to leave the Board of Rabbis. It's harming yeshiva. It's harming yeshiva's relationship with the Agudas HaRabbanim. Ultimately, it's harming yeshiva on a financial level because all these Rabbanim helped raise funds for the yeshiva. And Jacob Agus writes the following letter to Rabbi Revel. In accordance with your express wish and in deference to your authoritative opinion, I have today resigned as a member of the Rabbinical Association. I have taken this step in the full knowledge, Rabbi Rubin, you'll understand this better than anyone. I have taken this step in the full knowledge that of the improbability of an Orthodox rabbinate being organized in our vicinity. And despite my realization of the embarrassing and isolated position in which I was thereby placed, I hope and pray that my step may prove helpful in closing the ranks of Orthodox Jewry. And hard to believe, this is Jacob Agus, later becomes not just a conservative rabbi, but he becomes a reconstructionist conservative rabbi. At that time, no one dreamt. Today, the whole conservative movement is reconstructionist. Every halakha goes out the door. But at that time, no one ever dreamt you could reconstruct Yiddishkeit. The conservative movement still claimed it functioned within the framework of Dvar Hashem, Zu Halacha. And here is Jacob Agus bowing to Rabbi Revel. All right, at that time he was still a Torah Jew, but you could see already he's got a little bit insight there that is not promising. When he talks about, I don't believe the Orthodox rabbinate will ever get together. We will not have our own organization. And what he's alluding to, and this is a problem that haunts us until today, we Orthodox Rabbanim, at times, we always think we're right, no one else is right. And you see, Rav Yosef, when you read this, he's willing to put Rav Melamed into Nidui for speaking with this reform woman, rabbi, etc. Yes, people have said to me, it's the nature of the beast because we Orthodox Jews believe with all our heart and soul. And therefore, we criticize others. I will say that one of the greatest gifts I got from the Rav is you have your point of view. There are other points of view out there. And this was something that we saw all the time. The Rav could give his shear and tell you how to fight Hasidim halachically and challenge them. But that was on an intellectual level. On a practical level, there were Talmidim who would sneak into the classroom, outsiders, Chassidish Yidden, at downtown when the Rav gave the Tuesday night Shi'in Maria, many Chassidish Yidden, his love, his understanding for Chassidus. So it doesn't mean he was a Chassid. No, he disagreed with them on Shmini Atzeret. By the way, a student said to me, Mark Licht, Mark, you're wrong. Mark Licht says, why did the Rav challenge the Hasidim that they don't eat in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeret? Why not that they don't sleep in a sukkah all sukkahs? The Chabadnikim don't sleep in a sukkah. The Belzer don't sleep in a sukkah. And I'll tell you, you can't really challenge that. I don't sleep in a sukkah. I have many grandchildren who sleep in a sukkah. But I explained to my grandchildren, I grew up in the United States. Believe me, it was too cold to sleep in a sukkah. I live in an apartment in Israel for the last 51 plus years. It's the top floor of a building built on top of a mountain. You're in a mountain, so that I'm really not the sixth floor, I'm really the 10th floor, because we're on the side of a mountain. In front of the house, I'm the first part of my house, I'm only the sixth floor. But the back of the house, where my bedrooms are, Ribbono shel olam, if I would try to sleep in a sukkah, I wouldn't be around today. I would have caught pneumonia many, many decades ago. So all right, there's a din of mitztaya. I have to tell you, I basically almost don't drink water out of the sukkah because I have a sukkah right off my living room. My grandchildren, and this year a great-grandson helped put it together. And we call it a breakfast sukkah. It holds one or two if you squeeze. I used to build a big sukkah when I was much younger, but now my daughter can build a sukkah for 50, and it's just, we eat there the main meals on Yontif. Can I hurry? She lives a 10-minute walk. We're older, a 12-minute walk, but it's not the Kedesha Yase. But you can't really attack the chassidim because they don't sleep in a sukkah. You can come up with many heterim, mitztaya. But not to eat. Shmini Atzeres, when the open Gemara, Mem Zayin in Sukkah, Yetev Yatvin in Barach, Loma Barchinan, oh boy. And then he says, Tvila Shalom Bizman. All right, Tvila Shalom Bizman, Chabad. In my neighborhood, I think it's 10 o'clock, they start davening. I don't understand it. Ger, I understand it's Makpid Anzman. But Chabad, you have what to argue. But nevertheless, the Rav, there was a break kite in him that you could accept. He spoke about, in what I consider my biggest contribution in the Rav, in the second volume, where he talks about, I translated from the Yiddish, where am I different from Shur Shofol Hirsch? It's a fabulous piece. But on the other hand, if a Yekka walked into class, the Rav would welcome him with open arms. And yet, Rabbi Agis is right. There's always machloket between us. There's always this feeling, I'm right, you're wrong. And I can understand what he's saying. And if he would have the fellowship of the Europäische Rabbanim and then the Orthodox rabbis, it's one thing. But now he's left with nothing. And with the Reform and Conservative, they don't agree on halacha and religious matters. But when it comes to general matters, Zionism, public image of the Jews, etc., financial questions, interrelations with non-Jews, he's perfectly at home with the Reform and Conservative. Anyway, you should know this is the first time I don't find it anywhere else. I've researched and researched. I'll be happy if someone can show me they have another source. But as far as I know, 1939, Boston, Jacob Agis, Dean Zah, Rabbi Revel, what a letter. And this is the first time this issue rises in the United States. Synagogue Council of America was organized in 1926. It lasts until 1994. I need not tell you to swing to the right. What was in 26 is not in 94. The world has changed. Now, when it's organized, who are the founders? 26 Union of Orthodox Congregations. There is no Rabbinical Council at that time. No RCA. You have United Synagogue, which is the conservative lay body of synagogues, which corresponds to the Union of Orthodox. And then you have the Rabbinical Assembly, conservative. You have the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, Reform, and their rabbinical organization, the Central Conference of American Rabbis. So when it began with five organizations, three lay and two rabbinical, because there was no Orthodox. The element in synagogue, in the Orthodox Jewish congregations, the element at that time felt totally at home in synagogue council. Totally at home. And among the early presidents of the synagogue council, you have Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein, you have Rabbi David de Sola Poole, Look, they didn't come from, there was no RCA yet. Totally at home. Why were they totally at home? Because the synagogue council from the very outset made rules and regulations that governed them and avoided any real controversy. The first rule, and the most basic, every organization has veto power. So that tells you right away that they're never going to be able to reach agreement on a halachic issue because the Orthodox will veto if it's against the Vah Hashem. Every organization has veto power. By the mid-30s, rabbinical council is starting to function, and RCA joins United Synagogue. So now you're balanced. You have Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, each one with two. One a lay organization, one a rabbinic organization. No one but no one raises any issue before World War II. After World War II, as we know, the immigrants come in, the great Rosh Yeshiva come in, the Hasidic Rebbeim come in. To a certain degree, we have to mention Rav Yosef Breuer. At that time, they have a real kehillah and real influence from within their own viewpoint and hashkafa. As I mentioned down the line, ultimately, it's just the Litvish and the Hasidic influence that remains, and the German Kehila, basically, some chose to go the Lakewood way, some chose to go the YU way. Tinek began by people leaving Washington Heights on the Upper West Side. If you chase the history of Tinek, you'll find Englewood, Tinek, you owe it to the Breuer Kehila that those communities began. Sitting in front of me are members of those communities, and you don't even know that there's a German concept. Today you're caught up in these Kehila, that's YU, and perhaps more broad, but the world has shifted. Now, this new element is not happy. They already were not raised in America. They were not born in America. They don't have to go to Yankee Stadium to feel that they're integrated into America. And they're greatly disturbed by this mutual friendship, this feeling we're all colleagues, Orthodox, Conservative, Reform. To show you how sharp this feeling is, I want to quote to you from a recent issue of Mishpacha magazine. I apologize to Ami magazine that made me world famous, as if to speak. You can't believe how many people, even today, I got an email as a fallout from that article. Oh, wow. All right, I apologize to Ami, but it was Mishpacha that this quote is from. If you remember, I spoke to you, I mentioned Reb Chaim Dov Keller. Reb Chaim Dov Keller died a few months ago. Rosh Yeshiva of Tells in Chicago. Very fascinating for us because he was Nachum Lam, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lam's chavruta, friend. Buddy, Teira Vadas, Yeshiva College, they dormed in one room together, I'm told. And Reb Chaim Dov went on to become a beloved Rebbe. I'll read you a story about him in a minute or so. But I just want to quote, he was a Telsa, he was opposed to YU. He broke with his Chavrutha. And this is one little story about him. The Rosh Yeshiva, he found Rav Chaim Dov Keller, heard about a program that included an Orthodox rabbi as well as representatives from other denominations. Of course, the Orthodox representative didn't agree with their heresy, but he referred to them as, quote, my colleagues, end quote. Now, I have to tell you, I've appeared there, you know, it was a different world back in 69, 70, the 70s. So there were radio programs in English here. There was a whole, maybe I'm sure Dr. Hexter remembers this. Charlie, do you remember the programs in English? There was a whole series of English radio during the week, which no longer exists as far as I know. And of course, they needed people to come down and liven up the programs. So a number of times I appeared on programs, I debated with Orthodox Reform. I can tell you stories, but it's not for now. And how do you refer to the Reform, to the conservative? Do you call them rabbi? It's a very delicate question. I called them doctor. Some had doctorates, some didn't have doctorates, but I'm not going to call them rabbi. I don't know if I was smart or not, but that's my feeling. Others will say, look, Mikdei Daka Shalom, what are you antagonizing them? All right. If you call them my colleague, could be my colleague. So this Orthodox rabbi referred on the radio to the conservative Reform, my colleagues. With powerful emotion, Rav Keller exclaimed, my colleagues? You call them my colleagues? They are bent on destroying any connection to Torah Moshe. And you call them my colleagues? Ellie, you're sitting? Listen to the last sentence. Would you call a drug pusher my colleague? This is an emotional issue. He's right. Look at his point of view. Someone is teaching, you can be Mechalel Shabbos, you can be Ochlein Avelet and Treifot, you can abolish Tarat Mishpacha. That's your colleague? He's as harmful to us as a drug pusher. All right. Of course, there may be another point of view. I'm just trying to show you how deep this machloket is. You can make a case and say, look, these are tinokot shenishbu. We're not dealing with people. Jacob Vegas, it's very hard to say, is a tinok shenishba. He grew up in YU. We had smicha from Rabbi Revel, from Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. But these people, what do they know? Why antagonize them? But this issue cuts to the very core. Look into the Rambam, Hilchot Mamrim, Perek Gimel, where he deals with, or Perek Bet it is. Yoma, look it up. The Rambam, Hilchot Mamrim, I think it's Perek Bet. Gimel, I'm right the first time. Perek Gimel, he reaches it. Okay, so you don't have to look it up. And he deals there, who's an apikoros? Famous Rambam. And if someone learned and knew, but someone who grew up already in this generation, how can you say anyone's an apikoros? It's tinokot shenishbu. They grew up and they were taught from the time they were 30 days old. Yiddishkeit doesn't matter. There's no concept of Shabbos. We have to move with the times. A kashrut, you can slaughter a pig in the hospital today under sanitary circumstances. We have showers in the house. There's no apikoros. But you see, this is Rav Chaim Dov Keller. Think, would Rabbi Lamb talk like this? You understand? You see already this schism, this duality. How do you relate? In American Orthodoxy, beautiful example, Chaim Dov Keller vis-a-vis Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb. Rabbi Chaim Dov Keller, Rabbi Norman Lamb. And these are very sharp words. By the way, for point of identity, Rabbi Chaim Dov Keller was a brother-in-law to Beryl Wein. Rabbi Beryl Wein, Morty, did you know this? Rabbi Beryl Wein and Rabbi Chaim Dov Keller are married to sisters. Rabbi Beryl Wein's wife is not alive, but they were married to, they're the daughters of Rabbi Levine, I believe, from Detroit. You can check it out. And they were married to sisters. And here you see Rabbi Chaim Dov Keller. Would you relate to a drug pusher? My colleague. Now, I just want to say one more word about Rabbi Chaim Dov Keller. I don't want you to misunderstand me. He was a wonderful Rebbe. You never see a picture of him that he's not smiling. Some of my students were furious with Ami that the picture of me on the cover of the magazine, I'm not smiling. Of all the pictures, but they don't. That was a picture he took of me in the office. Had I known he's going to use that picture, I should have sat up like a mensch and smiled. Dr. Norman Gold was raising the roof in West Hempstead. He probably knocked down a few houses. He was so angry. Rebbe, to every picture of you with a smile. Why not? All right. Rabbi Chaim Dov Keller, you never see him not smiling. Never, never. Every last picture of him is with a smile. And here, in 2017, the Rosh Yeshiva traveled to Eretz Yisrael for the chasana of a granddaughter. At the time I had the schus, I'm reading the way they wrote it, of having the Rosh Yeshiva's great-grandson Lazer in my shia. Through Lazer's efforts, the Rosh Yeshiva consented to give a drasha in our yeshiva. For a brief period of time, I was a young bacha once again in Tel's yeshiva, drinking thirstily from the life-nourishing words of my Rebbe. I drove the Rosh Yeshiva to his destination, took him home. But before we parted, I shared with him some sentiments. I said, quote, Rebbe, moving to Eretz Yisrael was rewarding. I grew so much, but the hardest part of moving to Eretz Yisrael was leaving my entire past behind, my family and my Bar Rebbeim, end quote. All right, this echoes my drasha that I trust you've all heard. Lech lecha miyascha mimoladcha mibeit avicha. The order is wrong. You leave Beit Avicha first, then the state, Moladcha, and then the country. But I always explain, the hardest thing to leave is your immediate family, your Rebbeim, your davening, your chabura, your dafyomi, the people you grew up with and know intimately. So I understand what he's saying. So Rav Chaim Dov Keller turned to him and said, but you have big Rebbeim in Eretz Yisrael. I responded, they watered me and nourished me. I learned much from them, but Rebbe gave birth to me. The Rosh Yeshiva bent over and kissed me on top of my head. I would require any future Rebbe read that story and understand it. So you see, Rav Chaim Dov Keller, who I'm using, I've set him up as a representative of the swing to the right, the more right element. But you're dealing with a wonderful human being. You have to respect his point of view. You have to understand this is a very deep, legitimate argument. What would you do? Call a drug pusher? My colleague? You're a businessman. You have a whole chain of stores selling shaitels, right? Right here on the Rehov Keren Kayemet, there's now a shaitel store. Kanainhar, Kalkal. Right opposite the gymnasium. Halavai, some of the girls in the gymnasium should one day wear shaitels and patronize that store. But you're a businessman. He's a businessman. He's a drug pusher. My colleague. Very sharp. Very sharp. Food for thought. This is the start of the problem. How did the problem officially begin in America? Okay. So here I come back to the volume that I've depended upon for the history of RCA, Rabbi Louis Bernstein's doctorate. Challenge and mission. We've quoted it so many times. Go to page 141. The early 50s, Rabbi Hollander, I think it was 54, we spoke about it, Rabbi David Hollander becomes the president of RCA. Rabbi David Hollander, too, has a very famous brother-in-law, Rabbi Moshe Scherer. One tremendous difference between them. Rabbi David Hollander was, is, remains, till the day he died, totally committed to Mizrahi. Rabbi Moshe Scherer put Agudat Yisrael on the map in the United States. If there's an Agudat Yisrael in America, we owe it to Moshe Scherer. But Rabbi David Hollander was right of center on practical halakhic hashkafic issues. He's now president. And he starts raising the issue, what are we doing in synagogue council? Synagogue council, we're rubbing shoulders with conservative reform, to paraphrase Rabbi Keller, my colleagues. Are these our colleagues? And he raises the issue. All right, the issue's now on the table. It becomes halacha lemaisa in 1955. What happened in 1955? There's going to be installation of the new offices of the Synagogue Council. Now, the Synagogue Council, in addition to having a basic rule that every organization has veto power, had another rule. 2 years the president is Orthodox, 2 years conservative, 2 years reform, the chozrim. And you continue Orthodox, conservative, reform. When it's an Orthodox rabbi, the installation is in an Orthodox synagogue. Conservative, conservative. Reform, reform. 1955. Abraham Feldman, a reform rabbi, is going to be installed as president of synagogue council, and the installation will take place in Temple Emmanuel. Well, this is a tremendous problem. Temple Emmanuel, we're talking the flagship Reform congregation in the world. Fifth Avenue, Temple Emmanuel, no lack of money when it was built. It was all German Jews successful in the Civil War, their businesses, etc. Oh, what they built to rival St. Patrick's Cathedral. And Rabbi Hollander refused to go. President of the Orthodox Union was Rabbi Moses Feuerstein. Ah, this is the Feuerstein family from Boston. Feuerstein family that helped the Rav immeasurably throughout the decades. Helped equally Rabbi Aaron Cutler. What a family. Torah and Gedula b'makom achad. They were in the mill business, manufacturing clothing. This is all all before China took over the world, and today it's not China anymore, it's Singapore and Vietnam. I don't think clothes is made anywhere in the United States today. It's so much cheaper to import. This is a reality. One of the big problems of Israel. We once had a tremendous clothing industry here that employed so many people, manufacturing, and you didn't need college degrees. The immigrants, the refugees, today you can't keep anything open because the imports are so much cheaper. Labor is so much cheaper. So, Mo Fürsten went and made an official inquiry of the Rav, his Rebbe from Boston, which meant it would be an official inquiry for the Halachic Commission of the Rabbinical Council, and he awaited an answer. According to the research, the Rav told Fürsten and Hollander privately, you shouldn't go into Temple Emanuel. But there was no formal meeting of the Halachic Commission. There was no formal decision. At the Midwinter Conference of Rabbinical Council that year, there was a tremendous public debate between David Hollander and Manny Rackman, two very prominent rabbis. Reb David Hollander, you all know, as we said, right of center. Those of you that heard my Shayurim lectures last year, Manny Rackman, left of center. And Rabbi Rackman claimed that cooperation meant did not mean agreement. It meant mutual respect. And on the ground, he cited many advantages that would not have been possible without this mutual respect and cooperation. And he gave one example, that the kashrut in New York is now much more widely observed. And because of synagogue council, all public functions of Jewish organizations, of synagogues who belong to synagogue council, they're kosher. And the Orthodox expressed this feeling to the Reforming Conservative, we can only eat if it's kosher. You have to be considerate, even if we are a minority. So this is one example. Rabbi Rubin can tell you another example from Philadelphia. And it's a valid debate. And then, and no one knows exactly how this happened, I'll tell you what I remember, because I already was not a kid at this time. 55, I was graduating high school, I was already able to learn a Daf Gemara with Rashi and Tosfot on my own, a Pesach of the Rambam. I was already learning with Rav Noach Bornstein. Why, you had that tremendous advantage that a high school kid could be in a college shir. So my fourth year of high school, I was in Rav Noach shir. It's a tremendous advantage. I don't know if it's true today. I hope it is. But that's really something great that you have in YU. So I knew what was going on. And as I remember the story, it's as follows. And Louis Bernstein says, I don't know for sure how it happened. Mo Fürsten had already asked the Rav the Shaila. And the answer they got was not to go to Temple Emanuel. What happened was they didn't go, but nevertheless, RCA sent a letter of congratulations to the new president of synagogue council, the Feldman I mentioned, the Reform rabbi. Fine. That was, you know, to try to minimize any hot feeling. I think, if I recall correctly, Mo Fürsten was at a wedding. At that wedding was a Talmud of Rab Aaron Cutler. Rab Aaron was Masada Kedusha. And Mo Fürsten went over to Reb Aaron, and I guess He wanted to have conversation with him. Echad megedolei hador. So what's he going to talk with him about? Baseball, politics, American elections. So he asked Rabaran, he said to Rabaran, and I can live it in Yiddish, I imagine it was a Yichab, the Krugan and Einladen, I received an invitation, synagogue council, Temple Emmanuel. Should an Orthodox Jew representing the Union of Orthodox Congregations step in to Temple Emmanuel? And he asked Rabaran. Rabaran told him absolutely not.
Amen.
But this question, it's not a secret now. It's out in the open. RCA had a whole session on it. Rabbis Hollander and Rackman debated. Temple Emmanuel, Mo Feuerstein, the Rav was asked, Baron Cutler was asked. And then, to add oil to the flames, remember we spoke about the Rabbinical Alliance? The Rabbinical Alliance, Igor HaRabbanim, the younger rabbis who were rejected by Gudas HaRabbanim, and now they too are more at home in America. And they needed their own organization. So they weren't interested in Gudas HaRabbanim anymore. But they were right of center. These are Teir Vadas graduates, Chaim Berlin graduates. Today in the Rabbinical Alliance, I understand there is a YU presence. There is a YU presence. And they asked an official question. Can you belong to synagogue council? Now, why are they asking the question? They're not members. They're not part of synagogue council. It's only RCA. But by now, the RA is daydreaming that they're going to take on RCA. They're going to show that they are room. RCA is not. Don't forget this sentence. It's very important. We'll come back to it next week. And they turn to Rav Aaron Cutler. They want a psak. And Rav Aaron now senses that it's time to move, to be clear. It's 1956. The swing to the right is a reality. The right wing now feels self-confident. In 1946, what do you think, Benjamin? They would have taken on synagogue council in 46? Absolutely not. They were greenhorns struggling to establish themselves in the United States. By 1956, Noah, they have established themselves. The roots have taken in the ground. And now they are ready to take on what is happening. Time to change. And within a few days, there's the official psak of the 11 Rosh Yeshiva, that it is absolutely forbidden to join a mixed conference council of synagogues and a mixed council or board of rabbis. Notice board of rabbis takes you back 1939 to Boston. And they are spoken loudly and clearly. And all 11 signatures, one after another, are the most prominent Rashi Yeshiva in the United States. We'll get to the names. It represents every yeshiva from Yesidim, Yeshiva University, to Lakewood. Tells, Nevadik, Mir, Teira Vadas, Chaim Berlin, Nei Yisrael. None of the prominent yeshivot are missing. And yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Elchanan. And now you can imagine, I'll take a question and then I just want to make one more point on this. You can imagine the dilemma of the Rav. Here they're pressing RCA, already asked the Rav. Now they have an official psak. They want the halachic commission to respond. Do you agree? Do you disagree? The halachic commission, who are we talking about? The Rav, Rav Shmuel Belkin, Rav Chaim Heller, and a few yeshiva U graduates, the more learned ones. This was the halachic commission. Well, this was 1956. Today is the year 2021. There has never, we always, Eisehu Chacham Haro'eh Et HaNolad. You don't open your mouth today without thinking what the influences are 1 year from now. What year is it now? 2021. Don't forget that. Gentlemen, 1956 to 2021, there has yet to be a decision of the Halachic Commission. Now, there was a reporter for the Jewish newspapers, a very intelligent individual, a wonderful individual. He taught at Stern College for many years. I'm talking about the late Reb Aaron Ben Zion Shurin. He had a beautiful column in the forewords, and he explained the Rav's dilemma. On one hand, it was obvious the Rav did not agree with this Issa, with this Chayrim, as it was called. On the other hand, do you think the Rav is going to come out and publicly defy, disagree, contradict 11th great Rashi yeshiva, including his own cousin, Reb Moshe Feinstein? Remember, Reb Moshe's mother and the Rav's grandmother were sisters. Rebbetzin Pesha, the Rav's mother, was a first cousin to Reb Moshe Feinstein. Makes the Rav and Reb Moshe a first cousin once removed. Reb David already was a second cousin to the Rav. The Rav never gave an answer, never went public. Reb Moshe Feinstein, with his great sense of humor, so everyone would bother him. Was tracht euer Cousin hier? What does your cousin think? Reb Moshe said, I'm quoting, this is absolutely true. He says, in Chazal mehobna klal, in Shas we have a klal, shtika kahoda, that when you're silent, it means you admit, you agree. Shtika kahoda, someone says to you, you owe me 100 shekel. And you don't say a word. To witnesses say, it was totally silent. It's a sign you admit it. You owe me 100 shekel. Reb Moshe said, Damo, this time, Reb Moshe said, I'm afraid we can't follow the klal of Chazal. My cousin's silence does not mean he agrees. If you're familiar, Elie Weinstein, do you own a set making of a gadol? Ach, what are you, a poor individual? Put out a few $1,000 and buy yourself a set that you'll enjoy, that your wife will enjoy, that will only gain in value over the years. Keep it in the safe. Well, if you are familiar with making of a gadol, he tells you all the pressure they try to put on the Reb Moshe. Speak to your cousin. Lay down the law to your cousin. Familiar with the paragraph there in Making of a Gadol? The Reb Yitzchak Kutner, others went to see Reb Moshe, Yaakov Kamenetsky, could be Rav Ruderman, and when they walked out and they couldn't budge Reb Moshe to start a machlekes in his family, so that's where Reb Yitzchak Kutner said, only those who learned in Slabodka with the Alter of Reb Nosson Zvi Finkel, only those know how to be Rabbanim who are really communal leaders. Get the implication? Reb Moshe, who never learned really in a real great yeshiva, it was his father, Reb Pesach Priskin, afterwards he learned with Shtat Rav Shikolov, I believe. Reb Moshe, he didn't learn in Slabodka. You see, he wouldn't budge. All right. This is that moment in time. Rabbi Shurin's analysis is correct. The Rev couldn't come out publicly. And it's perhaps a lot deeper. When we come to the Rev and we spend a lot of time listening to his words, the Rev had a much more nuanced position, which is very difficult. It's very easy to be right of center and say, Asa, forbidden. It's very easy to be left of center and to say, my colleagues. The Rav was right in the middle, a very nuanced position, which is infinitely much more difficult. So on one hand, the Rav agreed in a theoretical level. On a practical level, the Rav disagreed. So I think there's even more to that article of Rabbi Shurin. Rabbi Shurin simply deals with it, that the Rav was not one to make machloket with Rashi Yeshiva Gedolei Yisrael. Remember, Reb Moshe was the Rav's cousin. They had an intimate relationship. The Rav, when he had a difficult shaila, who did he turn to? No, Reb Aaron Cutler, you all know, I've spoken about it so many times, with the shaila of taking Jews out of Cuba on Yom Kippur. Remember the shaila or not? It's been there, you can find it online today. It's Rabbi Weingarten, David Weingarten tells the story. They finally got Castro to agree to let Jews out, and the flight was leaving on Yom Kippur. And they called the Rav. David Weingarten headed up this committee, was a travel agent, a big Mizrachiite. And David Weingarten called the Rav, Rebbe, we're getting Jews out. What do we do? But the plane is leaving Yom Kippur. And the Rav said, call me back in 2 hours, I will give you an answer. The Rav told them, get them out, all costs, pikuach nefesh, spiritual salvation. The Chafetz Chaim, Russian Jewry. I'm giving you code words. I trust you know what I'm talking about. So, turned out that Castro was not an anti-Semite, and it simply was, that was the nearest plane. When Castro found out Yom Kippur, he agreed they could go out a few days later. It wouldn't be a shaila. But the shaila was real at the time. Many years later, David Weingarten meets the Rav at a wedding and says to him, Rebbe, when I called you about that shaila, etc., etc., how come you told me to call you back in 2 hours? And the Rav looks him in the eye and says, because I had to consult with Reb Aaron Cutler. No, now I ask you, could the Rav come out and throw eggs in Reb Aaron Cutler's face? Okay, this is where it stood, 56. It's a very important date in the history of Torah in the United States. Yes, Benjamin, your erudite probe.
When the Rav got to America, we mentioned that he had a difficult time. Wasn't it because of his relationship with the
No, the Reform Conservative have nothing to do with the Rebbe's difficult time. It was with his own Jews. You got to hear my lectures on the Rebbe to start talking about the 30s, but you're talking about the Rabbanim, the Shlachtos, the Hashgacha, the jealousy. The Rebbe tried to put standards in. The rebellion, the rabbis against him, they're worried about losing their Hashgacha. What went on? Or the famous story of the Rav. I write about this in the Rav. Benjamin, in order to breathe air, required reading.
Okay, are you Washington?
Revel, Silver, the Rav, Washington. Those are five volumes there.
And
Das Tater. Excuse me?
And the forthcoming volume on Das Tater.
God give us strength. I have it all outlined, but I need a year to put it all into words. But then Rakafed Aaron is icing on the cake. Got it? Anyway, let me tell you one story. The Rav comes to Boston, and he's now, the Chevra Shas brought him there. Those are a few shuls that got together. Each shul didn't have a rabbi, but they needed a Rav to give a gshir, Chevra Shas, and he would give hashgacha, and that's how he made a living. Not easy. So the Rav comes into the shul. Yontif fell on Shabbos. You can check it out on the calendar. What year? This is 32, 33. It has to be 33. Yontif fell on Shabbos. And then Yontif falls on Shabbos. They're not going to duchen. And the Rav insisted they duchen. The Balabatim were furious. And the Rav insisted they duchen. After Shabbos, the Balabatim met. We will never allow this new rabbi into our synagogue. He is a Machalo Shabbos. The Rav was never allowed into that shul again. I don't know how many years the Cherem lasted. You understand what I'm talking about? The Amratzit here? I grew up in the Bronx. They did not duchen in many of the shuls when Yontif fell on Shabbos. Idiots. Why don't we duchen every day? Because we're not besimcha. So we only duchen on Yontif. When Yontif falls on Shabbos, Allah had kama v'kama, you should duchen. There's the simcha of Yontif, the simcha of Shabbos. But the Amratzit that broke out over the time, the Rav had a very hard time. It was generation, division, lamdanim, no lamdanim. The Rav spoke about, I think it's the Rav too, Rakefet quotes it. The Rav spoke about the first wedding he performed, and he's filling out the ketuvah, and he asked the Chatan, are you a Kohen, a Levi, or a Yisrael? And he said, it's like I stepped off the moon. He looked at me, the American Chatan. Kohen, he never in his life heard of a tripartite division among the Jewish people. This is what you were up against. The Rav said, I will get Olam Haba. His greatest achievement, he organized Maimonides. You don't start to understand what this man, what he encountered. And the trial, not the trial, but the state investigation in the early... Please, read the Rav, study it. Not just read it, study it. Or go back to YU Torah. Benjamin and Noah, I'm going to suggest for you, look for a grant that you can take off the next 7 years and just listen to the Shigurim on yutorah.org. At the end of those 7 years, you will agree with Ami Magazine, this is a good
man. So we mentioned the Rav had a hard time in terms of his connection with it. Said that was referring to opening Maimonides and sort of
sent them. Opened Maimonides, everyone laughed at him. No one wanted to send a kid. You'll raise greenhorns. They learn English. They won't speak English. Father, you crazy? Even the Rav said a terrific word. The Rav said the problem in America was not that they weren't from Jews, that the from Jews had given up on America. We're going to lose our kids. We're going to lose our grandchildren. There's nothing we can do about it. they had given up the battle. All right, let me reiterate. I apologize to all those looking at me on screen and those in the United States. I bow to your diligence, staying up all night to hear us. We have students in front of us now. The room is a little bit more filled because they have to sit apart. The room is entirely filled. 2 meters, 2 meters, 2 meters, 2 meters, etc. What do we do today? All right, today was a very important ground. We're setting the groundwork because we have a lot more to do. But there's no question that this, how do we relate? No one has the perfect answer. Do we call them rabbi? Can you use the word colleagues? What's fascinating is that already in 39, we uncovered that this problem existed in Boston. And there's Dean Czar, and there's Jacob Agus's letter. All this I saw with my own eyes. That's amazing. And you have no idea, when I was doing my research, these were in garbage cans that were ready to be thrown out. Yeshiva had no archives then. And I was able primitively to Xerox all those Xeroxes, if that's a photograph. I don't know what they were called then, Xerox machines. I don't recall. But over the, what were they called?
A mimeograph.
I don't know. I can't recall. No, not a stencil. It was a Xerox. It was a photograph. But all these photographs disappeared over the years. It wasn't like today that a Xerox stays. It just, if I would look at something I photographed with, that's the right word to use, in 1963, you can no longer read it. It just loses, it was a whole, Baruch Hashem, as far as that goes today, these Xerox pages remain good indefinitely. So the problem, after World War II, no one raised the issue yet. The immigrants, the great Rosh Yeshiva, the Chassidic Rabbeim, were just integrating. But by 1956, it already began in 54 and 55. It comes to a head with entering Temple Emmanuel, and then Mo Feuerstein asked the Rav, asked Rav Aaron Cutler. The version I gave you, I'm willing to bet, is correct. I remember it. But we have nothing in writing. And Louis Bernstein, with all this research, says, I can't understand, I can't explain why Mo asked both. I think I have seen in writing about the wedding, that he met Rav Aaron at a wedding. I recall Torah Shabbat Peh, that he met him at a wedding, and I understand what happened. He wanted to talk of Rav Aaron Cutler. So this is a nice topic to raise with the Lakewood, with the Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva. The issue, the Iser is issued, the Rav doesn't sign, we'll pick up exactly where we left off. I got to tell you in advance that Sunday Shir next week is very, very special, dealing with intravenous Yom Kippur, normal living, how do we approach halacha, and I'm going to quote something unbelievable from David Applebaum, Hashem Yikom Damo. Yes, Noah, what's the question?
Rabbi, I don't understand. What's the svara that the Rosh Yeshiva advanced for why entering a non-Orthodox synagogue or working with non-Orthodox Rabbanim would be? I don't see how it seems like a public policy issue, not a bona fide issue.
No. What you're raising, I'm going to deal with that. I don't know if I'll reach it next week, but we're going to reach it. And you'll see Seda, Das Tera, that's where you ask the question. But the issue is, my colleague, no one hit it better than Rabbi Keller. My colleague, what are you saying? I was asked to speak at, what do they call that, where it would have teachers from all over?
Limud,
in England. I was a guest of the London community, fine, of Ne Yisrael community, fine. So I told them, what does the chief rabbi say? Chief rabbi is not going to participate. I said, so you expect me to come as a guest? But I said, you got to understand the problem. If I participate here, Rakefet is speaking in room 101, a conservative rabbi room 102, a reform rabbi room 103, A humanistic rabbi who doesn't believe in God in room 104. A lady who's not even Jewish, she is patrilineal, only her father is Jewish, she is not, she's a lesbian, a rabbi in room 104. You know what that's saying? You pay your nickel and you take your choice. That's the exact opposite of Naseh V'Nishma. My dear students, I want to thank you all for participating until we meet again in health and happiness. Das V'Dalia. Morty, can you open it to questions?
The recording has stopped.
Are there any questions?
Rabbi, Chaim Navon spoke about it. He said he asked Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. And Rav Aaron said to him, if you don't show up, the Reform rabbi will still be there. So what did you accomplish by not showing up?
No, beside that, that's again, yesh panim lakan v'panim lakan. But this is a very difficult issue. Because the Reform Rabbi will be there, correct. But if you show up, it shows my colleague. I can't say it any better than Rabbi Keller. By the way, it's a very legitimate question. You see that we haven't reached a haskama, a hitgapshut, a crystallization until today. Look what you have in this freebie, Shvi'i, with the pictures of the two Rabbanim, and Ad Kedei Kach, he wants to put Rabbi Melamed into Nidui. Okay.
Just a footnote, if you will. Hi. Number one, my friend Mr. Avalo just informed me that Ad HaYom HaZeh, we duchen at Maimonides on Shabbat, Yom Tov Shechal Yom HaShabbat.
Good.
And interestingly, we also duchen this, I remember personally, we duchen on Simchat Torah, but that's a different story. The Rav simply advised the Kohanim not to make Kiddush, to be very particular, not to have Kiddush. And lastly, just want to mention, you mentioned Chevr Shas, it was Mr. Avalo. He should live and be well. It's his father's.
His father, of course.
The Yoshev Rosh.
Of course.
Rabbi Leo Avalon. Rabbi Rishon, the Chevr Shas, who was instrumental in bringing the Rav to Boston.
I believe I do homage in my work, the Rav, to the Avalo family. And I'm very in debt to Joey, because he's the one, when I was doing my research on the terrific scandal with the kosher, remember? And we could, no one could get the name of the judge that headed up the commission that investigated him. It was A.K. Cohn. What does A.K. stand for? And Joey went to the judicial. They have a building with all the records in court. And if I recall correctly, he came in and there was this Afro-American, a big, heavy woman sitting there. And the minute he asked about Rabbi Soloveitchik and what happened, she said, oh, you mean the Kashrut controversy? And she got him the papers. I told Tova, Abraham Cohn, that was his name. And he would come every year before Rosh Hashanah and drink a l'chaim with the Rav. He was a Reformed Jew, but his derech eretz for the Rav was overwhelming. Read the Rav, where I tell you what the results were in Rabbi Shubo's article. The only time Hapades published an article authored by a conservative rabbi. Okay? Don't let anyone fool you. If anyone says Hapades, tzadikei yesod olam. But one time they published an article, Rabbi Shubo's article, in honor of the Rav. My dear students, I have a meeting upstairs, and another class is going to come in here shortly. I apologize that I gave full attention to the students in front of me, but that's the nature of the beast. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. I'm looking at a beautiful screen filled with people. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das V'Dalia.